Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, we're checking out some exquisite bodies. Actually, they're a bit gruesome. We're looking at how freak shows and sexy Victorian wax cadavers have helped medical science.
We've had some visitors peeking behind the curtain who looked like they wish they hadn't afterwards.
It's quite hardcore. It's actually quite hard to look at. It almost should carry a health warning.
We'll look at why you're doomed never to find your way out of a desert, how boats and planes could power themselves from water, plus Arnie might have stopped the self-aware Skynet computers taking over the world.
The computer which controlled the machines sent two Terminators back through time.
Trust me.
We look at real-life autonomous machines. They raise issues more important than the future of the human race. For example, how do you overtake a truck that can think for itself?
What we're offering is a system that is probably probabilistically far safer than the existing system.
That's all on Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. With me in the studio today is The Guardian's Nell Bowes. James Randerson will be joining us a bit later. Nell, you've done biology in your time, haven't you?
Quite a long time ago.
Did you ever have one of those anatomical models in your classroom where you could take bits apart and look at livers and hearts and that kind of thing?
Ah, definitely.
And did they teach you?
And, of course, operation, which is clear.
Which is exactly the apotheosis of this stuff. Well, any self-respecting biology classroom usually has an anatomical model of a human sitting somewhere at the back. A useful teaching aid for sure, but also one with an intriguing past. Wax models of the human form became popular in the 19th century as medical schools needed something to show their students. Some took the form of alluring females that could be stripped and split into different sections. Others were more macabre, showing the body ravaged by venereal disease, tuberculosis, and alcohol and drug addiction. It's a story told in the latest exhibition at the Wellcome Collection, Exquisite Bodies.
Some of the material in the 19th century anatomy museum would have been curtained off or kept in an annex room. This was due to the fact that it often discussed the subject of syphilis, which of course was rife at the time. And there were few causes for this disease. So in a sense, the graphic nature of the models that are behind this curtain was an attempt to communicate to people the message that prevention is better than cure. We've had some visitors peeking behind the curtain who looked like they wished they hadn't afterwards.
It's quite hardcore. It's actually quite hard to look at. Mm. It almost should carry a health warning. Do you know what I mean? It's very graphic.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, why isn't anyone else actually kind of making noises? Or yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's very, yeah. I could never be a doctor.
It seems very, very silly. Those cartoons should be drawn. Like, it is the 21st century.
It's quite shocking for a lot of people. Quite disturbing.
It shouldn't be. It's part of life.
It is very graphic, isn't it?
Yes.
It's like they almost do seem like real.
These models are all from a collection that was set up in Barcelona at the turn of the century, just off the Ramblas in the city's red light district. So it was obviously communicating to a certain demographic of people about their high propensity to disease. It's rather remarkable to think this was taking place in a Catholic country. It was actually supported by the Spanish Ministry of Health and run for a while under the auspices of the Red Cross before it closed in 1936.
So that was a clip from producer Andy's video tour of the Wellcome Collection's new exhibit, Exquisite Bodies. You can see it at guardian.co.uk/video. To help us understand what we've just heard, we have the curator of that exhibit, Kate Ford. Kate, welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
So we heard you talking about the exhibit just now and the sort of kinds of the reasons that it's happening. But can you tell us what kinds of models are actually there, or what the history of those are?
Yeah, the models range from the very academic, very skillfully detailed models of the kind that were actually used in laboratories and to teach students about what they should expect to see when they performed an actual dissection. We've got a wonderful selection of models from Guy's Hospital, which are still used by students at King's College today, made by the maker Joseph Town, who was a modeller in residence there for 50 years. But then they also range to the much more macabre and grotesque examples that would have been shown in fairgrounds and travelling circuses, and that were really designed for audiences who would have been more familiar with visiting a freak show.
And these were waxwork models?
Predominantly waxwork models, that's right. A lot of these collections would also have shown preserved parts, actual parts of humans in jars, and they would have been complemented by a series of lectures lectures on subjects ranging from embryology to diet to sexual health as well.
And how accurate were they? I mean, how much did people really know in the 19th century about the sort of function of things and where things were?
Some are very accurate because they were based on dissections of the day. Others, I think, partly because their intention was to communicate rather strong messages. They were more crude and more designed to sort of shock people into an awareness of the perils of disease and to advise them to be, you know, less promiscuous and be careful about hygiene.
So this is what would happen to you if you decide to sleep around. You're going to get this disease and your arm will fall off or
precisely
whatever.
Precisely that.
I mentioned earlier that they were used in medical schools as well. So they were actual teaching aids as well as for members of the public.
That's right. I mean, you have to remember that real corpses would have been deteriorating rather rapidly in the dissecting theatre. So in a way, these models are used as a complement because they can be studied for long periods of time. And they can also, as I say, inspire people to know what they should look for when they perform an actual dissection for the first time.
And there just weren't enough cadavers to go around.
That's right. There was great pressure on the medical community to come up with enough bodies. And this is all happening at a time when there's various scandals involving grave snatching and people being murdered so that their bodies can be sold to doctors in order for them to carry out dissections.
I was just interested in, you were talking about the kind of freak show element of this and the sort of public education element of it. Did you look at von Hagen's Body Worlds when you were sort of thinking about putting it together? I wondered how you felt about that sort of modern day versions of this.
Yeah, I think exactly. It is a modern day version of the Victorian anatomical theatre in a way. I think von Hagen's does owe quite a debt to the Victorians in the same, and his displays are also quite spectacular in the same way that theirs were. We did look at von Hagen's displays, but I think ours is not real human tissue, of course. That's one of the main
key point
issues. These are all models, they're surrogates, and I think there's something very interesting about having to come into contact with surrogates rather than real live bodies, real things.
Who made these models? Because some of them are beautiful and in their detail and almost like works of art. And we're displaying them like works of art in the exhibition. And who made them? Were they artists? Were they sort of technicians? Who were they?
The early modellers, the 18th century modellers, were certainly artists or regarded themselves as sculptors. They would have been working with leading anatomists to create these rather idealised portraits in wax. So there's a wonderful Florentine Venus in the show, which can be dissected into many, many different pieces. And but she's also, she owes as much of the sort of history of art and religious iconography as she does to scientific understanding.
Well, that's another question. Why mainly women? Why were the healthy ones mainly women?
I think partly because the women were an alluring way of getting people into these displays. And
Not with their livers out, no, surely.
Well, it's that sort of fascination with gore and fascination with beauty that's kind of connected with these wonderful, strange objects.
Is that why, I mean, there seem to be a vast proportion of them also pregnant, which is sort of,
that's absolutely right.
Hugely out of proportion.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think because in the history of sort of Western anatomy, the normative figure was male. So when females start to appear on the scene, what's interesting about them is that they're always pregnant, generally, because it's
the
a way
difference.
Of considering the mysteries of life. That's the main difference, and that's the main thing that anatomists want to discuss.
Were there mistakes made in these models from a medical point of view that we look at and think, well, that's just not the way it goes? And I'm thinking about things like pregnancy.
Absolutely. The early stages of pregnancy could not, of course, really be depicted accurately, certainly in the 18th and early 19th centuries. So you see sort of perfectly formed little babies at stages that are not at all accurate. But again, you know, this comes back to the fact these models weren't just used as medical illustrations. They were they were attempting to be quite didactic, sort of pedagogical examples to inspire people about the beauty of the human body.
And did they work? I mean, did people flock to these exhibits?
Apparently they did. There were around 7 or 8 different establishments operating in London in the mid-1800s. And one of these, Joseph Kahn's, was attracting over 2,000 people a week at the peak of its popularity.
So I'm interested, how does that fit in with the sort of prudery that we associate with the Victorians? Does that, it seems to sit a little oddly.
it's another great paradox about the Victorians, in that I think on one level we regard them as being, you're absolutely right, prudish, but I think in a way these spaces are actually quite radical, in that they were discussing issues that were quite taboo at the time, such as childbirth and venereal disease.
So they're not prudish about naked bodies as long as they're sliced open, naked bodies. that's okay, isn't
that
it?
That appears to be the case.
One of the things that we heard in the clip earlier was some of the people who were at the exhibit, just members of the public, and they seem quite horrified by something. I've got a note here saying, ask you to tell me about the red curtain. What's the red curtain? I don't want to spoil it for people who want to go, but what is the red curtain?
Well, there's some challenging material behind the red curtain.
Challenging. That's usually a euphemism for
it's quite scary.
Horrible.
it's quite sexually explicit material, because it goes back to that question of syphilis, really. And the reason it's there is really to explain to people that syphilis and gonorrhea, those kinds of STDs, were rife at the time. And there is a serious message here. You know, the message was prevention is better than cure. And that's what people would have been shocked into thinking, I think, when they saw these things.
Are you secretly pleased that people are shocked by it still?
A little bit, yes.
Okay, well, if you want to see that syphilitic wax model, then you can go to the Wellcome Collection. That's wellcomecollection.org. Warning, typing exquisite bodies into a search engine may generate unwanted results, especially if you're at work. But you can see a wonderful video, of course, of producer Andy going around the exhibition too. guardian.co.uk/video. Let's take a look now at some of the other stories and blogs on the website this week. Here's James Randerson and Nell with the News Jam. News Jam.
Cases of liver cancer have tripled over the past three decades, according to figures published today by Britain's leading cancer charity. In 1975, there were 865 cases of primary liver cancer. By 2006, that had risen to more than 3,000. Britain's changing drinking habits over the last three decades are partly responsible, according to Cancer Research UK. But obesity is another cause. The third contributory factor is infection with the hepatitis C virus.
It's a common theme explored in countless Hollywood films, but a legionnaire lost in the Sahara Desert really is likely to walk in circles. Researchers have discovered that people deprived of navigational aids or reference points find it impossible to walk in a straight line. In the study, participants were only able to maintain a straight path when the sun or moon was visible.
The US Navy thinks jets might one day be fueled by seawater. The Pentagon might not be the first place that comes to mind when thinking about alternative energy sources, but according to the New Scientist, that could all soon change. Navy scientists want to make the fuel by extracting the carbon dioxide dissolved in seawater and combining it with hydrogen to make something equivalent to gasoline.
And finally, a warning if you're a female, especially down at the disco. You shouldn't fall for a flashy display too soon, since the male may not be able to keep it going for long. Well, that's the case in sticklebacks anyway. Males attract mates by turning their throats bright red, but it seems that females ignore this signal early in the season when it isn't a reliable indicator of a male's quality. Since the display is costly to put on, only the males who can keep it up win over the best lady sticklebacks.
James, Nell, thanks very much. That was quite a sort of Leslie Phillips ending to that last story, James. I don't know if you had read it before or anything. Something serious, liver cancer, the rates have tripled. What, James, take us through those figures again and the various reasons behind them.
Yes, 1975, 865 cases of primary liver cancer, and in 2006 that was up to 3,108. And it's, as ever, to do with obesity and binge drinking, and also the third primary cause is hepatitis C infection, which you can get from contaminated blood products or if you're an intravenous drug user. But I suspect out of those, you know, obesity is the one that's...
And all these things are increasing. So obesity, we know, is increasing. People are just getting fatter, and that's all a cause of many ailments. But drinking, I mean, people might know causes cirrhosis, but does that lead to cancer? I mean, is that something that is worrying medics?
Well, it's certainly one of the causes. I'm not quite sure how well understood the sort of direct mechanism is, but you know, certainly there's good epidemiological evidence that is the case. I mean, this sort of ties in almost in other cancer news this week. There was a report about children eating salami in their packed lunches because the World Cancer Research Fund had done some research into bowel cancer, and they reckon that 10% of bowel cancer cases in the UK could be avoided if we ate less than 70 grams of processed meat a week.
And that's pretty old research that's been quite conclusive, but it's come up again recently, actually, because this idea that children and adults, I suppose, are eating too much of this stuff and that they should be limited to a certain amount every week, which includes sausages and bacon and all these things which make life delicious, I suppose. That and alcohol. What's left? What's left?
As so often we come to what's left.
Cream.
Not allowed the good stuff.
Fresh cream.
Alok, I wanted to ask you about the seawater jets. This sounds like an incredibly intensive way of generating fuel, isn't it?
Well, the Navy wants to take the carbon dioxide dissolved in seawater, and there's a lot of carbon dioxide in seawater. So in the atmosphere, carbon dioxide is something like 0.04% of the air. But in seawater, it's more than 100 times that. And the idea is you would extract this carbon dioxide, and then you would somehow split water using electricity to make hydrogen, combine the hydrogen with the carbon dioxide, and you've got some sort of fuel. This is similar to the artificial leaf thing we discussed last week. It's a very valid way of making, you know, new fuels for things like planes and so on, or cars even. But it all comes down to whether the electricity you use to split the water comes from a renewable source or not. If you're just burning lots of fuel and coal and things to split that water, it's not renewable at all. I'm not sure how renewable the Navy wants to be, particularly.
I mean, why are they doing it? Is it about not carrying vast tanks of jet fuel around with them?
If you've just got one form of fuel and you need jet fuel in the middle of the ocean somewhere, you just set up a little distilling plant and you make jet fuel and you know, fly your planes. I mean, I don't know. The thing is that military research is somehow useful to the rest of us eventually, so maybe this will push forward the artificial leaf stuff.
What about the Sahara Man?
I don't know what to say about this, because I thought it would be obvious that you'd walk around, unless you've got a frame of reference, you just walk around in circles, wouldn't you? Because one leg's probably longer than the other, and you, over any sort of time, you'd walk in the circle. Is that surprising?
I never noticed Alok's limp.
Well, you know, anyway, if anyone can tell us more about that, then you can stick it on our blog at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And you can also find loads of stories there, including one on Usain Bolt and how he might get even faster at the 100-metre sprint as if he needed to.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Whenever we need to discuss ethics on this podcast, we usually look to the movies. Fictional machines are often somehow malevolent, a very non-machine trait. Think about HAL in Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, or even Skynet in the Terminator films. But is this all fantastical? Well, the Royal Academy of Engineering isn't leaving anything to chance. They reckon that within a decade, we could be routinely interacting with machines that are truly autonomous. These are systems that can adapt, learn from their experience, and make decisions for themselves. Free from fatigue and emotion, they'd perform better than humans in tasks that are dull, dangerous, or stressful. The Royal Academy of Engineering published a report last week exploring some of the social, legal, and ethical implications of ceding control to decision-making machines. Here's one of the report's authors, Will Stewart.
Well, the instruments would be designed to be suitable for the vehicle. Remember, your biology can only operate in certain ways. So an obvious example is that we judge the ranges of things using binocular vision. That's because the speed of our nerves is not fast enough to do radar-type measurements. The machine doesn't have that problem. So the likelihood is that they will use laser radar to give themselves a 3D view of the world in front of them. One of the issues we're concerned about is, of course, they're programmed in certain ways, but they're also programmed to learn. They are thinking machines, and therefore they will remember previous situations they encountered, and they will react differently next time they see that situation, which means they will learn in a beneficial way. But that does mean that nobody ever decided exactly what they were doing in exactly this situation. And that's because it's too complicated, frankly. The machine is simply too complicated to run through every possible situation. But that's also true of a human driver. When we take a driving test, or your teenage daughter goes on a driving test, she has not encountered every possible danger situation. She's encountered a sample of them, and you rely on her being sensible in the other situations, and the same will be true of the machine.
How long do you think it's going to be before we have fully autonomous cars on the road?
Cars is an interesting question, and probably quite a long time. The earlier one will probably be trucks. So because keeping them going 24 hours a day, is much more beneficial financially, and they're much more expensive anyway. And also because, frankly, they're much more dangerous. And one of the pressing motives for automation is to make things safer. And autonomous vehicles are likely to be safer than hand-driven vehicles. And frankly, a 42-ton truck is a dangerous object, regardless of how it's driven. One of the problems I foresee is that when there is mixed traffic with autonomous and manual vehicles on the road, one of the obvious dangers is that people will know the autonomous ones are well-behaved and will start to take advantage of it. You know, they will cut up an autonomous truck knowing that the truck will always try to avoid a collision. And that could turn out to be a problem. As far as the car is concerned, I think one of the most intriguing things that we discussed is, why do you have a car at all? You have a car just so it's available to you, but it sits in the garage most of the time. That's incredibly wasteful. So what you're really talking about once you get to the car, it's not an automatic car, but an automatic taxi, an automatic chauffeur-driven vehicle. I represented it to ministers, as we're all getting the sort of service ministers enjoy today. The vehicle is just there whenever you need it. That will change the rules. I see most of that as positive, but it will also be safer, cheaper, more energy efficient, because you avoid issues like congestion. So better in almost every way, but different. And it's the difference that we want to address in starting this debate.
Do you think people might feel differently about, say, a relative being killed by an autonomous vehicle compared with a human?
It's very hard to know. I think, frankly, that's a question for journalists rather than a question for scientists and a question for engineers. It's something we worry about. Is it true? Is it not true? Remember, we have automatic systems today. You can die because your automatic braking system failed, for example. So we are already dependent on machines all the time. I think if your relative is dead, if my relative is dead, I'm upset anyway. I don't know that I would feel very differently. I would perhaps be short of anyone to string up from the nearest lamppost. There will be a requirement to train the machine. So you don't teach it quite the same way as you teach a human. There will be an inbuilt set of rules. And I watched the DARPA Urban Challenge last year in California. And of course, they all obey the California Book of Rules, the what we would call highway code here, which of course normal drivers don't 100%. The machine does 100%. So it does have a set of rules it absolutely follows. But there is also the question that it will learn. It will see this situation before. It will know what happened last time, and it will use that next time around. And in that sense, nobody taught it. Experience taught it. Now, we're comfortable with that with people. It's what we all do, whereby a more experienced driver is safer. A more experienced machine is probably also safer, but you have this issue that nobody really taught it in the end. But it will be given a set of ground rules for the correct way to behave.
That was the Royal Academy of Engineering's Will Stewart talking to our reporter, Sam Wong. Let me just throw this open to you guys in the pod right now. Kate, would you be happy being driven around by an autonomous car in a peloton of autonomous cars, if that's the right word for a group of cars?
It sounds terrifying. And I don't know, it completely takes the pleasure out of the whole concept of driving. I can't understand who would want one of these.
I think it's more of a commuting taxi type thing, as Will was saying, wasn't it? Because he said the car is just there when you need it. Well, actually, sometimes it's more than just a taxi. It's an object that you might like quite a lot.
An extension of your ego.
Exactly, exactly. Nell?
Well, I think maybe you could have the sort of driving for pleasure side of it, and then the straightforward kind of the automatons there to...
So two cars. That's even more sustainable.
But no, I mean, I think the idea of the efficiency that you could get from automation in that sense is really interesting. And I kind of, but the scale of the kind of agreement that you would have to get from everybody in order to have a system that was able to sustain autonomous transport across the kind of network of roads is quite daunting.
I mean, there is some autonomous transport already in London. I mean, the Victoria Line's basically autonomous. The driver presses a button to go from one place to another, but it drives itself, and the Docklands Light Railway doesn't even have a driver. So these things work. I mean, the ethical issues, I mean, it's good to be talking about these early, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a kind of, as long as you're kicking off the debate while, and you're not going to get bogged down in theoreticals before you've got anything practical, it's sort of useful to get people mulling it over and thinking how they'd feel.
Well, if fiction is anything to go by, I don't want any autonomous machines anywhere near me. We're going to leave that there, but no doubt you have your thoughts too. You can leave a comment on our Facebook wall or post something on the blog. That's guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly.
Science Weekly.
Back to our guest, Kate Ford, now from the Wellcome Collection. Kate, The Welcome Collection's just over a year, 2 years old, or a year and a half old, roughly. You've done open heart surgery live. You've done this sort of macabre showing of venereal disease in places. What's next?
The next major exhibition and series of events will revolve around the question of identity. And obviously it's a huge and complex subject. So we're going to be looking at everything from the development of DNA fingerprinting and twin studies to the challenges faced by people needing gender reassignment. So it's going to be an absolutely fascinating and topical subject.
So everything from the ethics and the morals and everything of what constitutes an identity to, and then the sort of biology of it as well.
That's right, and the whole question of identification and the political nature of that.
Are you kind of going to tackle the whole ethical side of what it means to be somebody? Or
I think one of the ways that we're going to approach this is by using particular individuals to kind of personify these debates, because otherwise it could become rather conceptual and alienating, I think. So, for instance, we'll be looking at someone like April Ashley, who is the UK pioneer of gender reassignment, who struggled for over 35 years to get her new status officially recognised. We'll be looking, for instance, at Sir Alec John Jeffreys, who's a British geneticist who developed the technique of DNA profiling, but looking at his life story as much as his work in order to try to draw out some of these individual questions.
Alec Jeffreys' story is actually fascinating. And the first, I remember he told me that the first use of DNA fingerprinting was to prove someone's innocence, not to prove their guilt of a crime. He's kind of concerned about DNA databases now because he doesn't feel that they're good enough to sort of, it's not good enough to store all this information for people because you get all sorts of false positives and things. But fascinating man. Someday he'll win a Nobel Prize and he'll agree to give us an interview.
Plugged by Alok.
Yeah, well, every year I hope that the medicine or physiology prize will go to him, or the chemistry prize, whatever it is. But you know, they just keep missing him out, I tell you. Well, anyway, thanks to Kate Ford. We're going to leave all that stuff there. Thanks to Kate. You can check out the details of the Exquisite Bodies exhibition and also the upcoming Identity one at welcomecollection.org. That's two L's in welcome, by the way. Thanks also to The Guardian's Nell Bowes and James Randerson. Also to our scarily capable intern, Sam Wong. Don't forget to add your voice to the debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.